Well, good morning, and I thought as you're kind of settling down, I'd like to give you a little introduction to the incredible variety of Mexican musical genres, especially vernacular. So while you're getting settled down, let me play you some samples, because I have a feeling a lot of you don't have the vaguest idea what Mexican music sounds like and may think of the Herb Alpert and this Tijuana garbage as being Mexican music. So why don't we start off? This is one of the early, incredibly popular mariachis recording in the 1950s. The mariachi was indigenous to the state of Jalisco and became the big commercial music in Mexico during the 30s and 40s and onwards. Why don't we start with just a little bit of mariachi tapatio from the mid-1930s. In total contrast to that, but maybe not that far off, the violin became an incredibly popular instrument in the states of Tamaulipas and in the Northeast, basically, a music generally referred to as Huastecan music from the Huastecan region of northeastern Mexico. This is a group I just recorded a couple of years ago, Los Caimanes. I think they're one of the best examples of that regional tradition. You're going to get a really quick little rundown. Those were both sones. Actually, the son, I believe, began in Cuba, but it was totally adapted in almost every region in Mexico, and many people think it's the heart and soul of Mexican music. That is that highly syncopated, I'm not a musicologist, I'm not going to go any further in it. Once you hear a son, I think you understand what it was. Let's go to a woman who became well known in the 30s on this side of the border, who sang typical canción, simply a song, Lidia Mendoza. This is a fairly recent recording I made of her in the 70s, relatively recent. Played her own 12-string guitar, an amazing woman. She's still living in Houston, Texas, where she was born. You may say she's 100% American. She's also 100% Mexican. She hardly speaks any English. Extraordinary lady. Let's go down to the state of Michoacán. That's on the south west coast of Mexico, where almost, I would say, 90% of the field workers come from that now do all of the farm labor on the west coast, for example. And this is the harp-driven music of a conjunto michoacano called Alma de Apatzingán. typical campeón ranchera from the state of Michoacán, the little city of Apatzingán. If you've ever gone down there, you know what kind of an incredible isolated rural community it is, but a booming little town. A woman who again was born on this side of the border but became an enormous hit all over Mexico, who's still a big name. A woman who specialized in the bolero. In a way, I first didn't like boleros, but they're heavy songs. They're sort of like Billie Holiday's blues in contrast to Son House and the other blues singers, if you talk about ranchero music or Mexican popular vernacular music. Her name is Chelo Silva, and she sang nothing but boleros. Here's a sample of her. Much more middle class expression, but a very powerful one, Chelo Silva. And of course, there were many other great bolero singers, but she specialized in it. She lived this life. It's all about how heartbroken her unsuccessful marriages left her, and it's really powerful stuff. Well, finally, just a little taste of the music that has become extraordinarily popular since the 40s, and it still is. It's the northern mixture of, in the north, it mixed with the polka, which came from Europe, and you had Norteño music. Here is a sample of a group from San Antonio, but this music is all over Mexico now. Trio San Antonio. Well, okay, now you can get bored with my talk because I'm about to, I hope that gives you some sampling of why I love Mexican music so much. It's unbelievably varied. It has a vitality that I don't think any other country music has, including our own, which is in Opry land, sort of being ensconced in, well, I don't want to go into that. Anyway, there is an equivalent to this in Mexico, and schmaltz just rules the world. Anyway, I decided to document the Peerless label. Discos Peerless in Mexico, it was the first major recording, producing, and manufacturing firm. The Peerless label, probably under the ownership of Gustav Klinkwart, first appeared around 1929 with a 7000 series, which included several releases by singers, composers, and pianist Agustin Lara, who would soon become one of the major stars of Mexican popular music. This is the, of course, at that time it was all the middle class highbrow music. About 1931 or 32, the label began an 800 series, which soon introduced a new Matrix series, probably starting with Matrix number 1N by release number 829. On Monday, August the 14th, 1933, the firm was incorporated when Mr. Klinkwart joined with Eduardo Batista to form Peerless Incorporated, S.A. as it used in Spanish. It could well be that Matrix number 1N marked the beginning of this joint venture. The date of the incorporation is given in a special edition of Disco Mexico. It's a publication that they gave me there, devoted to the 50th anniversary of Peerless Records. And That came out in 1983 when that company celebrated its 50th anniversary. Eduardo Baptista brought considerable experience to the new corporation since he had previously operated the Olympia label, 1926 to 27, the Huichi label from 27 to 28, the Artex label from 27 to 28, and the Nacional label, which had waxed Guti Cárdenas and Tito Guizar, among other rising stars. By the time the Peerless Corporation began in 1933, many of the early stars had already recorded for American, Columbia, and Victor. Both of these giant American firms, along with Edison, had begun recording in Mexico around 1904 and made several trips until 1909, when the revolution made such field trips rather dangerous. By 1926, Victor resumed field trips to Mexico, apparently had agencies in Mexico City and Veracruz, who not only distributed the records and phonographs made in the USA, but also searched for talent. Victor, however, did not feel secure enough to open their own production and manufacturing facilities in Mexico until around 1935. Columbia apparently never returned to Mexico to make recordings after 1908, since they discovered that there was plenty of talent north of the border. Columbia, however, also had established distribution in Mexico, but did not build their own production facilities there until 1946. Affluent Mexicans who could afford to buy record players and discs were a small part of the population and were supplied with not only the latest dance hits, but also with Mexican music by American firms and their distributors. That is, I'm talking from the 30s, early 30s. Peerless, although the only Mexican-based record producing company, was handicapped from the start by being able to buy only obsolete American recording equipment and was only slowly able to improve its disc quality. The majors, then as now, were not anxious to help establish competition. Since most producers were also from the wealthy class, they only grudgingly and slowly acknowledged the fact that the tastes of the poor and largely rural population eventually made record companies successful, at least the one in Mexico. Vernacular soloists, duets, trios were soon outselling the operatic tenors so popular in the 20s. Peerless eventually built up an impressive roster of stars in the realm of popular Mexican music, including Agustín Lara, Emilio Tuero, Las Hermanas Águila, Pedro Infante, Lola Beltrán, Tona La Negra, Los Hermanos César, Miguel Aceves Mejía, etc., although few of them on an exclusive basis. The first hit Peerless had, according to Leo Porayas, quoted in that above publication, was in 1936 when Los Trovadores Tlalixcoyanos recorded Camioncito Flecha Roja, the Red Arrow Bus Line, no doubt about the trials and tribulations of riding on a third-class Mexican bus, which allegedly sold 3,000 copies. This was followed shortly by El Barrilito, the Beer Barrel Polka, recorded by the Conjunto of the Dominguez Brothers, which sold, they claim, around 5,000. Peerless, of course, you got to remember the Beer Barrel Polka at that same time here in the United States became the monster hit, just about established the whole jukebox industry. Peerless finally hit real gold when, under the artistic direction of Don Guillermo Kornhauser, they recorded the soon-to-be number one Mexican singing and movie idol Pedro Infante on November 5th, 1943. Peerless has continuously released music of all types under that imprint to the present day, from semi-classical to regional, not only recordings of Mexican origin, but also licensed masters from other countries. Collectors of rock and roll classics might be interested in Peerless's 78 pressings by the Rolling Stones, which were indeed available in Mexico in that format at that late date. Unlike Victor and Columbia, which opened their Mexican branches in the mid-30s and late 40s, respectively, Peerless published few, if any, listings or catalogs of their releases until the advent of LPs in the 1950s. Collectors, researchers, scholars, and fans of Mexican music had long been frustrated by the total lack of information available regarding early Peerless recordings. The only listings of releases I had ever seen were short lists of currently popular items printed on the sleeves of the 78 RPM records. We were told that around Christmas time, sometimes the label would run listings of their best sellers in the daily press, but we were unable to confirm this, and of course Matrix numbers were never given in any of those kind of listings. From past experience, I was aware of the fact that many record companies, especially in Mexico, are suspicious of anyone trying to obtain discographical information. They generally consider this confidential data because they feel it might reveal sales figures and or royalty payments to publishers and or artists, or lack thereof. Fortunately, John Clark, a friend of mine, brought a copy of one of Dick Spotswood's monumental volumes of ethnic music on record to show as an example as to what a discography is, a catalog of all the artifacts or holdings by matrix numbers, which a record company and or artists have produced, and that it is therefore a valuable asset to all those firms who have ever found it financially or culturally rewarding to re-release older recordings. This is going to be what I'm reading from. I should interject here, is actually my introduction to the Peerless discography that we have completed. But anyway, this gives you my summary of it. In 1994, a friend of mine, Professor Jaime Nicolopoulos of the University of Texas at Austin, who also helped me write the book on Lidia Mendoza, visited Peerless because of its intense interest in the corrido, that's the Mexican narrative ballad, and is working on an annotated catalog of all recorded corridos. He was kindly shown the card files at Peerless by Natalia Gonzalez, and in the absence of a complete catalog, painstakingly began to dig through them for every listed corrido to their card index. Unfortunately, the plant claimed to have no information on any releases prior to 1939, when the company moved to their new present facilities. They were also quite sure that no printed catalog of the label had ever been seen. A number of Mexican and American record collectors also expressed their frustrations about not knowing what precisely Peerless had produced over the years. I began to make plans to approach Peerless about the possibility of cataloging their productions, when Arhuli Records made some funds available via the Tide Foundation for research and documentation of vernacular music. This is my own little organization that I've set up about 3 years ago. We made a lot of money all of a sudden, and I decided to establish a little foundation. Since then, business has been absolutely terrible. In the summer of 1995, under the direction of Professor James Nicolopoulos, John Clark, a mariachi researcher, and myself, we requested permission to document the early years of the Peerless label. The head of the royalty department, Natalia Gonzalez, whom Professor Nicolopoulos had met the previous year, invited us to consult the documents in her office, but we had not received a formal invitation from the head of the firm. We figured it was now or never and left for Mexico, determined to document the label as much as possible. Fortunately, shortly after our arrival, we were able to meet with the then president of Peerless, engineer Jürgen Ulrich, who was born in Mexico but educated in German schools and fluent in that language. Due to my sad lack of proficiency in Spanish, we had a fruitful conversation in German about the importance of documenting the holdings of a firm such as Peerless. When Mr. Ulrich saw the impressive work done by Dick Spotswood in documenting ethnic recordings made in the United States, we were soon welcomed with open arms to begin our task with his complete cooperation. Mr. Ulrich personally gave us a guided tour of the large plant and showed us all the documents and artifacts still in existence. He also showed us the archives where the tapes for most LP releases were stored, and a rather messy room filled with metal matrices, which did not seem to be sorted in any manner. Examining a few here and there, we soon determined that they did not include any pre-1939 items. It became clear to us quickly that 1939 was the year when the in-house documentation of the Peerless label began. The firm moved to its present large facility that year, began a new matrix series, 1-39. If you have any Peerless recordings, the number after the dash is the year the record was made. That's a very useful matrix system. I wish all companies would do this. And so they began with number 1, dash, in 1939, so 39. The latter number indicating the year of the recording was made and began life anew by releasing Peerless number 1501 out of the blue. In early 1939, the last known release number pressed at the old plant is probably Peerless number 1369, at least that's to the best of our knowledge. And we can assume that there are no further releases exist in the 13 and 1400 series. There seem to be absolutely no records of any kind left dealing with pre-1939 recordings. I happened to look into the card index in the royalty room, and the very first card revealed the bad news, which in effect stated that all metal masters had been melted down because of the recordings not having been well recorded. Some items, however, from the pre-1939 to 46 period apparently became steady bestsellers and were re-recorded or new stampers were made from the old mothers. The same card also indicated that all metal matrices through 1946 were melted down as well. So there's very little metal parts left. Back to our tour of the Peerless plant. A very small room partitioned from a large space contained the most interesting artifacts from my standpoint, namely 78s and 45 discs pressed by Peerless since 1939. The run of Peerless pressing seemed to be complete in chronological order, neatly stored in albums holding about 10 to 12 discs each. All discs are in mint condition, file copies, one example of each. On one shelf, I discovered samples of pressings made by Peerless, but not necessarily issued by them. These albums, again, contain between 10 and 12 discs, each containing rather rare custom pressings, including some of Corridos, which on occasion had a picture on the label of the politician to whom, in whose honor the song was composed. Some albums contain samples of other labels manufactured by Peerless, including some later releases on the Orfeo label, which of course made me go totally baloney because that is one of my, a label that I'm absolutely hunting for, and some on the Texas label, T-E-X-A-S, among them. Although we began to obtain our data mostly from the label of the 78 RPM records themselves, because it is printed on the label, taking the matrix numbers from the lead-out grooves, this soon proved very time-consuming. Fortunately, Peerless prints their matrix numbers on the record label as well as the catalog number. When we got back to the office, Ms. Gonzalez discovered, to our delight, that books of label copy existed. And so the bulk of the catalog information and data was eventually derived from the label copy of each disc. The new and very logical matrix formula initiated in 1939 assigns consecutive even numbers to all masters beginning with number 2, followed by the dash and the last two digits of the year of the recording. Some masters, I should explain, they don't go consecutive like master 1, 2, 3, and 4. They go 2, 4, 6, 8, and so on. They only use alternate numbers. There are some that are even, and they told us that would be an alternate take. In general, Mexican companies do not believe in alternate takes. They figure there's one perfect one and everything else is wiped out. And that seems to hold true of almost every Mexican company I've ever encountered, including tapes. They would erase stuff until they're finally satisfied with something. Some masters were licensed from the United States and other sources. But it seems that no older or pre-1939 Peerless masters were reissued since they had indeed been destroyed. I did, however, find one box of about 30 old Peerlesses, which someone had obviously saved because of the famous names of the artists involved. The matrix numbering system continued up to the end of the 78 RPM era in the late 1950s. In a few instances, alternate takes were issued. These are represented by odd-numbered matrices. The other interesting artifacts which have survived are a set of original handwritten log books. These are really amazing old books. They're just sort of large, books that are just blank, and then they had written in diary. Anyway, book number one from 1945 to 50. Matrices, I can give you all those details if you wish. Since we were unfortunately unable to Xerox these fascinating recording logs, I hope they don't burn up sometime because they're really unbelievably interesting. John Clark did begin to transcribe some of the data from book number one, but it was a slow job and he soon gave up when I mentioned that our prime effort was to complete the basic catalog. These logbooks contain exact dates of recording, often names of musicians accompanying, matrix numbers, and alternate takes, if any. They also show interesting hand-drawn diagrams of the location of microphones and even cutterhead readings and other technical data for each session. The volume, which included the first recording session of Pedro Infante, was already missing, much to the concern of Mr. Ulrich and the man in charge of the archives. Unfortunately, without these logbooks, no complete and accurate discography of Pedro Infante or any of the other artists can ever be completed. Johnny Clark, who stayed on the longest, supervised data entry through release number 2391. That was issued in 1943. The bulk of the entry work was actually done for us by Miss Alicia Cornejo and there was one other woman, I can't remember, from the Peerless office, who did much of the entry work for us. Since the Peerless catalog prior to 1939 was not documented by the firm, and since no records of any kind other than a handful of 78s exist at the Peerless office, we turned to Mexican record collectors for help. The main bulk of the pre-1939 Peerless catalog information was generously made available to us by Armando Paus, probably Mexico's leading record collector, who has spent years painstakingly assembling this information primarily from the actual discs in his collection. Special thanks also go to the late Jorge Miranda, who had an extensive record collection which was recently acquired by Mr. Paus. However, as you can see, the pre-1939 Peerless catalog still has huge gaps. We hope that collectors who have items for which our discography lacks data will send us such details and thereby contribute to the eventual completion of this Peerless discography, at least up to the end of the 78 RPM era. I'd like to kind of I got some more stuff here. Okay, I got some comments about the type of program we used to log this material. Of course, the main thing was the catalog number, the matrix number, the artist name as on the label, the song type, which is very important in Spanish music, whether it's a bolero, a corrido, a tango, or whatever. The recording date, of course, we were pretty much there stuck to the matrix numbers, which is the release. Yeah, that's actually the recording date because that number was put in at the time of the recording. And that is very helpful, not at the time of issue. The holding as to who has the disc, the title of the selection, the composer, the accompaniment, and then we have some notes, reissues, and so on. But we can always add more data if one wants to in this program. We did not include the one category which interested Peerless the most, and that is the name of publishers of the compositions. However, we were not interested in this entry as contributing anything to the permanent discography of the two for the two main reasons. First, copyrights owned by publishers or composers are frequently bought and traded, and after many years, it is often difficult at best to determine who's the actual legitimate owner of such rights. And secondly, it is often even difficult to establish who is the correct and legitimate composer. This label discography begins with a number of entries of 78 RPM records. Okay, this is basically my description of the exact listing, and I think that just about concludes my sort of introduction to what we did. Of course, the wonderful thing about having a label on this wonderful new instrument called a computer is that you can then instantly dial up an artist you want, like which I did. The Huesca brothers, they're also he recorded under his own name, I think, too. They were typical of the Veracruz music with the harp. And I just asked for that, Los Hermanos Huesca, and here comes out their entire output for the Peerless label. And finally, one can tell. So it's a real delight to us, but I'm sure most of you, if you're not particularly interested in this, but it taught me a great lesson that I should really catalog my own holdings. And I'm beginning to do that, which is an enormous task. Okay, does anybody have any questions about this particular project or the type of... Dick? No, it just keeps going. Mm-hmm. They started with two, and at the end they're up into the 50, 100, 5,000, 60, 60, 100 series, and so forth. Well, if there are no other questions, yeah.
What software
do
you use for your data entry? Is APRL something?
Oh boy. Didn't think about somebody would ask for that. We have a, I should have brought it down. I have my little portable computer upstairs. It's a Mac, there you go. It's a wind-up, it's a Macintosh machine. And well, that's a good question. Maybe you can, no, you can't tell from the printouts, I guess. I'll have to check on that for you. Who's that?
The Bolero.
The Bolero, that was by a woman named Cello Silva.
S-I-L-V-A.
C-H-E-L-O, and then Silva, S-I-L-V-A. Those are available on some of my recordings. I didn't play you any samples of the Peerless label because I forgot to bring it. And so I played you some samples of Mexican music from my own production on the Arhuli label. And thought that gives you a sort of a rough idea. Yeah?
I wasn't clear about the numbering of the matrices, 2, 4, 6, 8, why they did that, what the purpose was.
They were not, they didn't seem to have any rhyme or reason. I think they just figured if there was an alternate take, then they wouldn't have a problem of sticking it in there.
There would be at the most one alternate take.
It would just be at the most one, yes. That seems, I mean, most of this music was really quite well rehearsed, just like really in this country. It blew me away. I thought Bob Wills was all improvised, but when I heard take two of Steel Guitar Rag, it was the same intro, Look Out Friends, Here Comes Leon. And that sort of blew me away. I thought that things were relatively unrehearsed when people of that type were recorded, but not so. They had to have a down cold. Any other? It's of course, in a country like Mexico, it's much more difficult for these firms to deal with archiving. Like, for example, BMG, where we went to, Victor has nothing left. No log books, no metal parts. They're even now destroying the LP tapes and putting them onto DAT tapes. And the new manager of BMG, he comes from the profession of tourism. So you can just well imagine what's going to happen to any archival. These people seem to be interested, and I think our documenting their label taught them that there is an interest in older music, not just yesterday's and or today's. Yeah.
Chris, did you bring copies of your current catalog?
Yes, I did. If you would like some, I have some, and I have a few samples here if you want to stop and say howdy here after. Well, okay, if that's it, then I can round it up. Good, thank you.
Thank you.